finish your year with your dream kitchen with help from Menards. Clearview Cabinetry offers a selection of finishes made with the finest materials and built to withstand life's sticky messes. They provide features like soft close doors and drawers and cabinet accessories to match your unique style. Don't wait to finish your projects. Save big money on Clearview Cabinets and check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening now. Save big money at
Menards. So we're good.
Well, thank you so much. We appreciate it.
No, good deal. I'm glad to.
So you are a judge, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
I had an episode with a lady a while back, and we talked about, you know, getting judges' cards and all that kind of good stuff. It's not like you can just call them up and get a card in a week. Like, it's a long process.
It is. It's a very long process. Very long process. There's a lot to it. A lot more than people probably think or know.
Well, I mean, when me and her talked about it, I was a little shocked, too, because, I mean, I've been around horses my whole life, and I thought, okay, well, maybe it's a month or two, obviously some tests. But, no, it's a long, like, you guys go through a little ordeal, and it's not. So how many judges' cards do you have? You have one for each specific thing, right?
Well, I have a APHA, which is American Paying Horse. I have Appaloosa, NSBA, National Snaffle Bit, ASHA, American Stock Horse Association, and I also have Gypsy Vanner Horse Society, which is the Gypsy Vanner horses with all the long mane and tail and feathers on their legs. The first card I got was NRHA, and I think that was around 2013 or 14, and I was fortunate enough to do that one first because they do a really good job of teaching you. And so, like, you apply, you are a judge's applicant. You apply to go test. So once you apply, then they approve or disapprove you. If you're approved, then you go to school, to their school, and then you test at the end of that. Now, once you pass that test, which consists of rule book test questions, closed rule book test questions, and video clips, once you pass that, then you go with all the carded judges who have to go every 2 years and recertify. So then, again, you go through a school, and then you test. So there's a lot of testing involved, but the NRHA school just taught me a lot about organization, and they have a really good way of explaining things. So I was fortunate to do that first. Now, I no longer have that card because I chose to give it up to feasibility or lack of feasibility of keeping it.
So you have to obviously do maintenance on these things. Like, you have to go back and keep them.
Right.
They're not like forever.
They're not forever, and you have to retest with the breeds every 3 years. And with NRHA, it was every 2 years. But you have to, every year you have to pay a fee, a judge's fee, and do a rule book test. And then every 3 years, you have to actually go back and retest at class. You have to go to a classroom for 3 or 4 days and retest again. So it's an ongoing process.
So you have APHA. Now, obviously, you can judge any discipline under that breed.
Yes, that's an all-around card, meaning any APHA-approved event, I can judge.
Okay, that makes it even more. Okay, so that's kind of cool because, you know, I was sitting here thinking, okay, well, you'd have to have a card to be able to do reining, or you'd have to have a card to be able to do, you know, whatever else, pleasure or whatever else. But that's cool that you're able to have that, like, umbrella.
Now, in Quarter Horse, they do have some specialty cards. You can be a halter specialty judge, and you get that by having a WCHA card, which is World Conformation Horse Association. If you have that card, it makes you eligible to test to be a specialty halter judge. You can be VRH, Versatility Ranch Horse, with Quarter Horse. You can be a level one judge, meaning you can only judge level one shows, which is also known as novice. Or you can have a full all-around card. And once you have the all-around card, you can judge any AQHA class. But now if you're going to do VRH, you have to have the VRH in addition to that.
That's crazy. I had no idea that it was that specific, like, especially in AQHA. I had no idea.
Yeah, it is very specific. And they, you know, I guess they're just trying to make sure everybody has the adequate training that's needed.
So you said you've been doing this since 2013, 2014.
Yes,
have you seen an increase since then, like from the shows that you've, you know, been asked to do and things like that? Have you kind of seen it just kind of go up and go down?
It has gone up for me, and I think once you get known, once your name gets out there and you're known, and have a good reputation, then obviously the amount of shows that you're hired to judge increases, and the quality of shows such as, you know, national type, national and world level shows.
I mean, like, have you seen, I worded that way wrong, have you seen like an increase in participants, like in the shows that you go do? Have you kind of seen it go from, you know, 20 to 30 horses in the class to a couple of heats? Like, have you just kind of seen the industry grow?
It depends on the region, and it depends on the discipline. The ranch classes are the classes, I would say, that have had the largest influx. The all-around, I would say, have had a decrease over the years at weekend shows.
Yeah.
And but now there's different areas in the nation that, you know, your Western Pleasure numbers will be really big. And another area of the United States, your Western Pleasure numbers are really small. But I would say overall, the ranch classes have grown, and the all-around type classes have had a decrease.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. And that's pretty much the same conversation, because a lot of people just are drawn to that, to being able to do that. It's got a lot of hype.
Still, it does, and there's more of a reality to it. It's mm-hmm. not as animated, and I don't mean that in any way whatsoever that's derogatory.
No, I agree with
what
you're saying.
It's just more realistic, and people feel like they can actually do it and compete and not have to have a $20,000 saddle and a $20,000 top and a $300,000 horse. Now, granted, the really good ranch horses they're pricey, but they're not $300,000.
Well, it's like, that's funny you brought that up, because we were just talking about this like the other week. You know, the cost of the attire for pleasure is insane compared to what ranch. It's like more emphasis and value goes into the actual animal at the ranch shows and the ranch associated events versus how it's been in other disciplines. And I think that's great. I think that's where the value should go, you know?
Right, right.
And you don't Agreed. Have to worry about it. Like, I saw this vest was, what was it, $7,000 or $3,000, and I about choked. I was like, oh, my God.
Right. Yeah, so, but, you know, the all-around.
Finish your year with your dream kitchen with help from Menards. Clearview Cabinetry offers a selection of finishes made with the finest materials and built to withstand life's sticky messes. They provide features like soft closed doors and drawers and cabinet accessories to match your unique style. Don't wait to finish your projects. Save big money on Clearview Cabinets and check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
It did go in a direction where the clothing, the attire, the saddle, the headstall, all the tack was just insane, the price on it. And those blue ribbon and Phil Harris saddles and the high-end saddles, they cost $20,000. And that narrows the number of people that can play on that platform, I feel like.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I feel like the ranch has brought in a whole another group of people that maybe at one time showed back in the 70s or 80s, but then as horse shows evolved and the all-around evolved into this really high-priced discipline, they just fell off. And then once the ranch came around, it brought them back because they feel like they can play.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's not as much, and I've said this before, it's not as much pressure. Like, it's not necessarily not, you know, that these horses don't do an excellent job or they're not at, they do. They do some crazy stuff. But, you know, it's not as much. I feel like the atmosphere is a little more.
It is.
Yeah, you pick up what I'm saying.
I would call it a friendlier atmosphere. Everyone roots for each other. They're cheering each other on. They're laughing, joking, having a good time. Now, that's not to say that they're not competitive. You have some fierce competitors.
Yeah.
But it's a lighter atmosphere, a lighter environment, and much more enjoyable.
Yeah. Now, of all of the things that you can judge and that you have judged, what type of shows do you prefer? Do you think you have the most fun at? Do you like to go to?
You know, I have really enjoyed everything I've judged. Like I said, I used to have an NRHA card, and I'll say, you know, when you go judge a five-day reining and that's all you see for 5 days, that got a little monotonous, and I didn't really love that. So, and that was one of the reasons why I chose not to renew that card. But as far as the all-around classes, I love looking at good horses, and I don't care what color breed they are. A good horse is a good horse. And so I truly love judging all classes. I obviously train and show and coach the ranch classes, but I love seeing a great Western pleasure horse. I love seeing a great showmanship run. I love seeing a great halter horse. So I love all of it. And the good thing about judging a show that has all classes is you see a variety of classes and a variety of different horse and rider teams, and that's what I enjoy. I just love seeing a good horse and good horse and rider team.
You just made me think about the peanut pushing days. You remember them days?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, but thank goodness they got away from that.
I know.
I can't say that there's a class that I dislike judging. So. I do enjoy all of them.
It's probably good to keep it fresh too for your mental. I mean, to be able to keep your, because you guys have to hold a lot of information, because those rule books are not like a pamphlet. Like, it's, they're thick.
That's right. And when you have multiple breed cards, there are some differences in those rules as well. But for the most part, they're pretty close to being the same.
Yeah.
But the penalties do vary from class to class, and so there's a lot of information you have to know and retain.
Yeah, I didn't know the whole how – I'm still a little, like, novice as far as the way the point systems go and stuff for the NRHA, which I think is kind of cool compared to being able to judge pleasure or all around, like you said. You know, I feel like that's more opinion based versus, because, you know, what if you have the class where literally everybody's good and you need to be able to separate people? That gets hard versus having a point system. You literally just, it's numbers.
Right. And, you know, when you get into Western pleasure, or what is the new quarter horse class, working rail, working Western rail, which is ranch rail.
What is that?
The new AQHA class is called Working Western Rail, and it is basically ranch rail pleasure. And it's like old school Western pleasure, where we like our horses to go more forward, necks up a little more elevated, and not so animated in their movement. We're still judging the quality of movement.
Mm-hmm.
and the consistency of the horse throughout the ride, but we're not so slow and animated. We are looking for a forward-moving horse. Now, Paint has that class, and they've had it for a while, and Appaloosa has as well, and they call it Ranch Rail Pleasure. In the quarter horse, it's called Working Western Rail. And what I was going to say about that in Western Pleasure is we do have a standard. We have a standard in what our trot should look like, or moderate extension of the trot, our jog in the Western pleasure, our lope should look like, our walk. And so we have a standard that we have in our mind, but then there is some subjectivity to it as well. And then that's the same in the ranch rail pleasure classes. We have a standard in mm-hmm. the way they should be moving, and kind of where their frame should be. And then from there, there is subjectivity to it. You don't have that score sheet like you do in the horsemanship, ranch riding, the trail classes, the reining, things like that. It does not have a score sheet. So we have to watch all the horses and find the best horse out of however many's in the class and place. And I was just having this conversation with a fellow judge last weekend. You know, I feel it's really important to get that fifth and sixth and eighth place horse right, because it matters to those people. It matters that they placed eighth out of 20 head. It matters to them. So, you know, a judge needs to have the attitude that they need to try to get it right from first place all the way to 10th place, or however high you're placing the class, because it matters to every single person in there.
So you mean you've had situations where people or other people have kind of just, like, I don't want to say slack off, but they'll just really care about, you know, if you do have to go into that subjectivity portion, you know, you've seen people that have kind of just knocked off after third or fourth.
Well, I don't want to say that. Yeah, I don't want to say I've seen it. That's not what I'm trying to say. I'm just saying I personally make an effort to get it right all the way through the placings, because I know it matters to that little girl or boy that just placed 10th out of 20. So that's what I'm trying to say is I really do try to get it right all the way through, because I do understand how the importance it is and the time and effort and money that it took for them to get there and show.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, I see what you're saying. You're absolutely right, because I remember showing, and I remember going to my, being, you know, 12 or 13 years old, and you're going in your first, like, swanky class, big class.
Finish your year with your dream kitchen with help from Menards. Clearview Cabinetry offers a selection of finishes made with the finest materials and built to withstand life's sticky messes. They provide features like soft closed doors and drawers and cabinet accessories to match your unique style. Don't wait to finish your projects. Save big money on Clearview Cabinets and check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening now.
Save big money at
with the big people that you know watch, and you know, if you that eighth or sixth means a lot, like you won the world.
That's true, and it does matter.
Yeah,
it's very important to that person, and it means a lot for them to place eighth out of 20 or 40 or 12, whatever. It does matter, and it's rewarding for all the effort and time that they've put in.
Yeah, no, I definitely, I agree. I see what you're saying. Now, you also travel. I know you're in Texas, but I know you kind of travel everywhere.
I do. I've traveled all over the United States, to Mexico and Australia judging.
Mexico has horse shows? Whoa.
They do.
You just blew my mind.
Yeah, they do.
Holy cow. Yeah. I didn't know. I mean, I know that there are people there, and it's like a working continent. I didn't mean to sound dumb when I said that, but I had no idea they have like a horse industry.
They do. Their horse shows are more of halter classes, judging confirmation of their horses. And they do have some reining over there as well. And they have like the charo events and that sort of thing. But their quote unquote horse shows is just halter. And typically it's like in a large round pen.
Yeah.
And it's very different down there, to say the least.
I had no idea. Like, you just blew my mind. And I knew Australia, I know they have a cutting association down there, and I know they have horse industry down there.
Yep, they have a paint association and a quarter horse association and cutting horse and camp draft. And they have a large equine industry in Australia. But they do in Mexico as well. There's a lot of horses in Mexico.
That is so cool to learn that. I had no idea. That's really cool to learn that. You know, I mean, you kind of get stuck like under a rock here sometimes, and you don't think outside the box that other things are going on other places. So it's really cool to kind of hear that. How long were you down there? Or do you go there often, or do you just do it once?
Well, when I went to Mexico, it's just for the weekend. It was just a weekend show. When I went to Australia, that was a larger, like a state show. And I was there judging for 4 or 5 days, and But I obviously went early and stayed later to tour the countryside.
And yeah, I would have wanted to stay.
I have a lot of friends that go to Europe. I personally, I've been to Europe, but not to judge yet. And yeah. And also Canada has a big horse show circuit.
I kind of knew that Canada, because we I sell a bunch of stuff, and we ship a bunch of stuff to Canada, horse-related stuff to Canada. So I kind of had an idea that, you know, Canada was right there with us. But that's really cool to learn about Mexico. And hold on, I want to touch into Australia. What was the best part of being down there that you got to see of the country? Because a lot of people they always have good things to say about Australia, like the food and the scenery and all of that kind of good stuff.
The people were great. The countryside was beautiful, and just learning their culture was a lot of fun. So I flew into Sydney, and actually where I judged, and I'm sorry, I don't remember the name of the town, but it was just outside of Sydney, not far, where they had held the Olympics, the equestrian portion of the Summer Olympics.
Yeah.
And I got to tour their the entire equine facility where they did that, and that was just amazing and breathtaking to see all of that. And then of course their countryside is just beautiful, and their different animals that they have, the wildlife that they have, is very different than ours. Like, you know, people think of kangaroos being, you know, really cool or whatever. Well, to them they're kind of a nuisance because they get overpopulated, and they, you know, they get in people's yards and eat their plants, and kind of like for us, the way deer can become a nuisance.
That's what I was just thinking. It sounds like they're deer.
Absolutely. And so, you know, we don't think of a kangaroo as being a nuisance, but to them, they certainly can be.
Yeah. I remember seeing a couple of memes or videos. There was this one, but they make kangaroos out to be like these big muscular things, like these big scary
right.
animals.
Right, and it's just like how when we drive at night on a dark country road, how we have to watch out for deer. Same thing for them. They have to watch out for kangaroos. Kangaroos are their deer.
Check that out. I had no idea. That's
right. Yep.
Now, that's funny you just brought that up, because I have an episode that's going to be coming up with a man who is a cult starter, and he's from Australia, and then he ended up in the United States. Yeah. And so, you know, he was saying it's pretty lucrative down there and a big market or whatever. But he said the biggest difference is that they don't have sales tax down there.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
And we have, because he said, you know, you could walk into a store down there and buy, you know, whatever, a drink for $2.99. You only pay $2.99. Whereas, you know, in America, you walk in the store and the price is $2.99, and you get to the register and it's, you know, whatever,
yeah,
sales tax and all that good stuff. Yeah.
I guess I didn't realize that, or I'd forgotten about that, but that would be nice.
Yeah, because we get taxed to death.
We get lots of taxes.
Yeah. So let me back up a little bit, because I just want to ask this. So were you, like, kind of born and raised into a horse environment, or did you grow up non-horse and then end up just deciding to get into horses at a certain age, or...?
Yeah, so I like to say before I was born, I was riding. My mother showed horses and also ran barrels. And so while she was pregnant, she was riding. And so I was born into this, and my mother was really good at showing. And my dad ranched and raised cattle. So I grew up in the industry, and just it became a part of my life early on, and I developed a love and passion for it, and have continued to do it throughout my life.
Well, that's kind of cool. You literally were riding before you were born.
I was. So I started out showing in lead line and open shows, and then moved up to 4-H, and 4-H was a big part of my youth, and I'm still very much an advocate of 4-H and try to help out all I can with 4-H. I think it's a great program. And from there, I moved on up to showing AQHA at the breed shows and showed all around, from halter, English, Western Pleasure, everything. And then I kind of evolved into reining, showing reining. I developed a love for reining and then cutting and cow horse, working cow horse. And always continue to show reining. But then about 2009 or 10, this really cool new class called Ranch, back then it was called Ranch Pleasure, came out in quarter horse shows. And that's what we now know as ranch riding. And we've been doing it ever since.
I was just going to say about the 4-H ordeal. I grew up 4-H, and you couldn't, it's like a kind of across the board average for those in the horse industry that experience 4-H. It's like a different, I don't want to say a different breed, but it kind of is. It's just kind of an unquestionable foundation for people that go into the horse industry that have been through 4-H. I think it just kind of sets you apart. You learn more about it, and you just get like a better handle if you've gone through 4-H in some way, shape, or form. And that kind of seems across the board for everybody I've spoken to.
I agree, and it just teaches you responsibility and respect for others and your elders, and it just teaches kids a lot of great life skills that will remain with them throughout their life and help them.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And I still do work for 4-H and for the state around here. So I think it's great. I think it's super cool. But
I do too. And there's so many opportunities as far as scholarships in 4-H mm-hmm. and FFA that I always highly encourage kids to be involved in 4-H or FFA or both.
But I do remember, you don't have to give reasons, but I remember having to, you know, you have to do like the hippology and the horse bowl and the judging.
Sure.
And I remember having to give reasons, and it was like my worst part. I always got so nervous about having to do it, and you forget. And I couldn't even do it now if you paid me money to. But I remember that specifically. It's like, why do they make you do that if in real life you don't have to give reasons if you do become a judge?
Well, it just makes the kids justify why they did what they did. And I think it also helps them with public speaking.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when those kids move on to collegiate and then on into their adult life when they get a job, it just helps them to justify why they placed the class the way they did and then get up and publicly speak about it.
Yeah. It was nerve-wracking.
And, you know, if a horse show had time, I don't think it'd be a bad idea for the judge to give reasons. Now, I do think maybe in the WCHA, and I may be misspeaking here, so I'm not even going to say that. But now, you know, in steer shows, the judge gives reasons.
Oh, cool. I didn't know that.
In cattle, right,
yeah.
Steers and heifers. In
yeah.
cattle, the judges do give reasons, and they'll place the class, and then they'll stand in front of the audience and tell them why they placed the class the way they did.
Well, you just made me think about something, because when I was younger, and it wasn't like breed show related or anything like that, but I remember it used to be looked at as like honorable or respectable, you know, like if I went in a class and I placed, or I didn't place or whatever, you could go up to the judge and go, hey, you know, what did I do wrong or what can I work on type of thing. But then, you know, another lady kind of explained it to me. You don't really do that now. They don't allow that now because it could leave room for question or politics or something of that nature, and it'll help eliminate that. I always thought that was a good thing, to be able to, like, ask the judge.
I agree, and you still can, like, at the 4-H level. I've had, you know, I've judged the state 4-H show in Texas and whatnot, and you have some of that, and that's okay, but I think there was kind of a barrier put up there to help protect the judges, because sometimes mothers get a little overprotective about their children and can get a little aggressive.
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, nowadays we have score sheets for the majority of the classes, with the exception of halter, the exception of Western Pleasure, Hunter Under Saddle, and working Western Rail or Ranch Rail. The rest of those classes, they have a score sheet, and that score sheet will tell you the story. It'll tell you what penalties that you had and how that maneuver was then scored. And the scoring is, depending on the class, but like your ranch riding, all of your ranch classes and your cattle classes and your reining classes are, when you walk in the arena, you start at a zero, or I'm sorry, at a 70. You start at a 70, and then you can score up or down on each maneuver. So a zero maneuver score means non-credit earning or average. Now, that score can go in half-point increments all the way up to a plus 1.5 or down in half-point increments to a minus 1.5. That is the scale. Now, there are some classes such as equitation, English equitation, and horsemanship, and those classes are scored in roping. Those classes are scored all the way up to plus 3 or minus 3.
Oh.
In half-point increments. But when you walk in the arena with all of those scored classes, as soon as you walk through the gate, you're sitting at a 70. And with each maneuver, you can move up or down the scale. And then that's how we come to a final score. But the show management will put those score sheets out after the class, and the exhibitors can come and look at their score sheet, see what they did. A lot of people will video their kid or their client or whatever, spouse, and then they'll take a picture of the score sheet. So you can watch your video and look at your score sheet and compare and, oh, okay, I see, yep. So my trot, I had a minus half. I see my horse spooked or whatever, you know. And it'll basically tell the story. So that eliminated a lot of that of people coming up to the judge and, and like I said, sometimes it can get a little heated whenever a mama is wanting to be protective over her kid. And I think they just try to keep that at bay.
Yeah.
No, I can totally see that for sure. It makes sense the way she explained it to me, what you're saying now. You know, I get that. It's crazy to kind of see how it's changed so much, you know. Not that it's a good thing or a bad thing. But
the score sheets are wonderful. They're a wonderful learning tool. And It is a great way to reflect on what you did right and what you did wrong and where you can improve.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely, because you can't, you know, do better if you don't figure out what you're doing wrong. You know, you can't fix
absolutely
it if you don't know what it is, right?
And another thing, I mean, if a kid comes up to me at the end of a horse show and I've just watched 200 runs, I'm probably not going to remember what you did and how you
true
can improve. So, again, we need to reflect on that score sheet. But I do want to touch on one thing. I do hear people make this statement a lot. Well, the judge doesn't like me or the judge doesn't like my horse. That's not the case. It's not that a judge dislikes the exhibitor or the horse. It's a judge just reports the news. We're news reporters. We report what occurred during that run.
No, you're right. No, you're absolutely right. Because, that can kind of go into the mentality of the competitor that you're dealing with. You know, some competitors will go, okay, I need to fix it. This is my fault. Let me go home and fix it. You know, and then you have some competitors who may not have that level of sportsmanship.
Right. You know, and sometimes you just have to put your ego aside and say, okay, maybe I need to present my horse in a different manner, and maybe then this judge would use me higher.
Yeah.
You know, you always need to, I feel like you always need to be evaluating how you're presenting your horse, because I can present the same horse five different ways and make him look like five different horses. And different judges have different preferences. So, I just don't like when people say, well, they don't like me or my horse, because 9 times out of 10, that's not the case. It may be how you presented your horse, and if you make some changes there, the judge, you would be, you know, it would be a little bit more to their liking.
Yeah. I did have a judge, though. I was dead set, knew he hated me. I mean, cause I tried everything I could with him, but this was ages ago. He was actually just really more harder on me.
Sure.
And like I said, you know, you can take that as a competitor. You can either take it and improve on it and let it make you better, or you can, you know, keep pointing the finger and then not improve, you know. I'm pretty sure you guys run across that a lot. I mean, it sucks to have to be the person to tell somebody, hey, you suck at this. You got to fix it, you know. I mean, to be in layman's terms about it, you need to fix this if you want to improve, you know. Some people can't handle that.
Right. No, that's right. Some people cannot take criticism. And I always tell people you learn by making mistakes. Mistakes are a good thing, and you learn by making those mistakes. And once you make a mistake, you learn from it, and you grow from it.
Yeah, that's the absolute truth. I mean, that's the only way to learn.
And a horse is the same way. So if you're training on your horse at home and he makes a mistake, that's a good thing because he will learn from it. He will learn not to do that anymore if you are aware that he's doing it and you fix it.
Yeah. Yeah, and you just made me, I want to touch back, you had said something that made me think about something. You are very right when it comes to you can have one person take that horse and another person take the same horse and get two completely different results, you know, because it does kind of matter on, you know, the day, what's happened, and how, like you said, like how you are presenting your horse, you know. You could go to a show one weekend and win it all, and then the next weekend not place at all.
Right.
And it's not necessarily the judge's fault.
Right.
You know?
And I encourage people to get some help because if you're – and even trainers have trainers. All those working cow horse guys, trainers, they have a trainer that helps them. Mm-hmm. And if you have a set of eyes watching you that can see things that you don't feel or know that is going on, then you can improve on it. So everybody from a beginner all the way up to a professional, they need some help, and they need somebody to watch them and give them some insight on how to improve or what they need to change or what they need to work on. Because if you're at home and you ride by yourself every day, you will keep doing the same old thing, and you don't even realize that you're making this mistake but it occurs every time you ride because you don't have another set of eyes telling you.
Yeah.
So whether it's once a month or once a week or every 5 days a week, if you'll get some help, it will definitely improve.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up because, like, the industry's so open now. It's amazing the tools that a lot of people have available, just like with social media, because, you know, before social media, you literally were riding at home by yourself. The only chance you got to get an insight was at a show if you went. And now people can hop on there and go, hey, this and this is happening, or hey, can somebody look at this picture? And I think that's phenomenal to be able to have that at your fingertips now, you know, people that are coming into the industry or even those people that, you know, didn't have it before. It's great to be able to do that because you're exactly right.
Right. And even, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, I developed, and it really didn't take off the way I thought it would. It did during COVID, but I developed what I call virtual lessons.
Oh, yeah.
And, I mean, the possibilities are endless today with all of our technology, but the way I would do it is the rider would be on their horse, and if they had some wireless earbuds and they had a person to hold their phone or tablet or whatever, we would basically do a Zoom call. And so I would be watching the horse and rider and talking to them in their ear. So it's like I'm there talking to them, watching them, but I could be hundreds or thousands of miles away.
Right.
So there really is no excuse as far as, well, I live too far away, I can't get any help. That's just an excuse. You don't want help. There are endless possibilities. You can write a pattern, have somebody video it, send it to someone, have them critique it, evaluate it. You can do the virtual lessons like I just explained. You can hook up, load up, and haul, and go ride with somebody. It's just endless. The possibilities are endless. So for somebody to say, well, I just live too far away and there's nobody around here to help me, that's an excuse.
Yeah. No, I totally agree.
you don't want it bad enough.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. Absolutely, totally agree. But now, so you actually do, you have a training, you do training and you have a training facility and you do lessons aside from just judging, right?
Right. I don't do as much training anymore. I've kind of limited that to a very small number of horses and a very small number of clientele that I take as far as giving lessons anymore. But yes, I do keep a few horses and a small number of customers that I give lessons to.
Well, that's kind of cool to be able to have that, that to be able to enjoy the thing that you judge. You know, it would it's nice to be able to have that little break of having to be on all the time, because, you know,
right,
you have to be the judge, you have to do this and do that, you know, every weekend. It's nice to be able to kind of enjoy what you're actually judging.
Right. And I'll tell you, being a judge has made me a better trainer and a better showman, because...
Oh, I could see that, yeah.
When you watch people and you watch a variety of people make the same mistakes on a certain maneuver or whatever, then I can actually take that home. I've learned from it. I learned from their mistake. So mistakes, I always tell everybody, mistakes are a good, they're a good thing. You learn from them and you grow with them. And so the judging has helped my training and coaching program and showing.
Well, yeah, you have to not have an ego, though, to let mistakes help you. People like me and you let it help us, but sometimes people, they can make the same mistake their entire life and still just keep on making it.
Well, yeah, hopefully we grow out of that ego thing.
It is, though. It very much is an ego thing. It's like saying, I don't make any mistake. No, we're all human. It's going to happen.
Everybody makes mistakes. That's right.
Absolutely.
Sure.
But, you know, I mean, we are dealing with horses, which kind of makes the whole hobby, profession, all of it even more harder for us, because, you know, you can only control yourself and you can only control that horse so much. And so, you
right.
know, I remember having those days where it's like, I'm giving 125 and it's not doing it, you know? So it's a hard sport.
It is. And, you know, I tell everybody it's imperative to find the right partner. Your horse is your partner, and you need to have a connection, and you need to have a relationship with that horse. And if you have that connection and relationship, most of those horses will give you everything they have.
Yeah.
But again, it's, you know, not every horse will fit every person, so you have to find that right combination.
That is true that you just said that, because, you know, a lot of people will go and blame, they'll see a pair matched up and go, oh, that horse is horrible, blah, blah, blah. And I've always looked at it like, no, maybe they're in the wrong environment.
Right.
You know, they all have potential. You might not be the person to bring it out. Maybe somebody
That's
else
exactly
needs to do
right.
it.
And I've seen it a million times. You know, maybe it's a colt, but somebody's starting, and it just, it's not progressing the way that it should or that they would like. And then that colt goes to another trainer, and that trainer gets more out of it. And it's just a different environment. It's a different program, and it works for that particular individual. And so you've got to find the right connection and the right team, and that's imperative. And the
yeah.
right discipline for the horse. A lot of, you know, I see that too. Horses are in a discipline that they hate. Like, that horse just needs a new job.
Oh, yeah. No, I couldn't agree more, because, like, you know, it's some of it you would think is common sense. It's kind of like having a horse owner go, okay, well, I want my 16-hand loud gelding to go do cutting and reining. Okay, well, he's not built for that.
Right.
Like, you're
right.
asking them to do something they really shouldn't be doing, you know, and it's not a personal thing. It's like what me and you were saying here. It's just a matter of, you know, putting them in the discipline that's going to work best for them. Take them to maybe show jumping or maybe some hunt seat. You
right.
might have a winner, but.
Right. But you're probably not going to have a world champion cutting horse.
No.
But it doesn't mean he's a bad horse either. Just because he flunked out of this program does not mean he's a bad horse. He just needs a different job, a different path, a different direction.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. And it's crazy to understand that people don't see it that way, because that kind of makes it more simple. It makes it more simple and less emotional. You know, oh, well, my horse ain't good enough. No, your horse is great. He's just not good for this. This is not going to fit him.
Right.
I would hate to have to do that. That's one of the reasons why I'm not a trainer, because I wouldn't be able to handle that.
Right. It's, you know, most people see their horses like their children, and it's like calling somebody's child ugly. They don't want to hear that. They don't want to hear that, and sometimes the truth hurts. And they had it set in their heart and soul that this horse, I raised him, and I wanted him to be a world champion cutting horse. And then he grew up to be 16 hands. Well, he doesn't have the physical ability to be a world champion cutting horse, so let's find a new job for him that he can excel in.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, or buy a horse that's equipped for what you want to do, you know.
That's right. Or you can go buy one.
Yeah, because it's very easy to – I'm kind of glad we're getting into this, because I'm the world's worst at bringing emotions with animals. Like, this is why I'm not a trainer, and I don't buy and sell. Like, I couldn't be able to do it. But you have to be able to take your – yeah, you have to be able to take your emotions out of it and look at it as a business. You know, the horse is the tool that you need to do the job that you're doing or the career that you're going in. And if you look at it like that, I would think what I'm saying makes sense. Then you would succeed, you know?
Right, right. And that's a lot of the reason why I've kind of downsized, is the animal does become a part of me emotionally. And I do sell a lot of horses, but I find them that good for ever home, you know.
Yeah.
So they're not being sold to where I don't ever feel like that I need to worry about that horse and his future. And then in the training aspect of it, I do get emotional, and I do have feelings for those horses, and so I'm a little different than most nowadays. I was there in the past where I had a lot of horses, you know, kept 20 head of horses and all that. You have to take that emotion out.
Yeah.
And I didn't like that. I didn't like that at all. And so that's why I really downsized, and I have a group of people that kind of have the same mindset I do. Mm-hmm. About their horses and how they feel about their horses and the way we take care of their horses. And so it is tough being a young trainer and having a large barn. And you have to take that emotion out and make it a business first.
I mean, that's a mental toll. I mean, that's a mental health toll on any human being to have to
expect
somebody to go, okay, well, care about this animal for me, but don't care about it at the same time. You know, I couldn't imagine having a horse there in my barn for 6 months, 8 months, or a year, and then you have to one day say bye to it. Like, it would crush me. I would be heartbroken.
It is heartbreaking, and I've had to do that on a number of occasions, and it just rips your heart and soul out. For me, it did for me, and that's why I say that's why I downsized. The group of horses I have will probably die with me, you know. So that's why I will not take on that large barn anymore, because it does. It just rips your heart out.
Yeah.
When they leave, they are a part. They are a part of my family, you know. And then all of a sudden they're gone.
Yeah. Yeah, I give major props to the people that have to deal with that, because, like I told you, my past could tell you I can't handle it. So it's like, no, I don't even need to go into that. But I'm glad they're able to handle it.
Yes. Yes. I don't envy them anymore. That's for sure.
Right. Well, I was going to ask you, though. So when you went, out of 4-H, I'm assuming, did you go to college and do, like, the collegiate thing there, too? Or did you just go straight into the workforce? Or did you...
Well, I went to college, so I went to Texas Tech University. Now, I didn't participate in any of the collegiate equine events in college.
Yeah.
I did go back to Texas Tech, and I did coach the horse judging team for a semester and taught horsemanship for a semester. But at that time in my life, I decided that wasn't really what I wanted to do. I just wanted to focus on training horses and people. So I did not stay that course in academia as far as teaching there.
And then you just kind of wandered into judging kind of full time.
Well, you know, I did judging in 4-H. Whenever I was in 4-H, I did horse judging. And I always knew I wanted to be a horse trainer and be in the horse industry my whole life. And my parents made me go to college, which I'm glad they did, and I think it's very important. I think it's important to have a backup plan. I'm not saying you must go to college, but I think you need to have a backup plan and the resources to be able to survive if something were to happen to you physically where you're not able to train horses.
You need to have
a backup plan to be able to make a living. And so whether it be college or a trade or whatever, I do think that's very important. So, but like I said, I did not do any judging in college, and I only did it in 4-H. But I just started judging open shows, 4-H shows. I would go and sit with other judges and learn from them. I did a lot of scribing. Scribing is a great tool to learn. You learn so much when you scribe for a judge, and I did a lot of that. I scribed at, like, the NRHA major events, futurities and derbies. I scribed at the Rain Cow Horse World Show, World Greatest Horseman, a lot of their weekend shows. I would just go and scribe and learn all I could.
And, I had no idea. I had no idea. I didn't mean to cut you off, but I had no idea that you could describe. I had no idea that even happened. Like, I didn't know you could do that. I always thought the judge was there, and you had a ringmaster. I remember having a ringmaster, and then, you know, you would have shows that would have, like, two judges or three judges. But I had no idea people scribed until recently, until I thought, like, I would see people post online, if anybody wants to scribe here or do this or do that. I had no idea that happened.
Yeah, you know, and I think back years ago, it wasn't as prevalent because the scoring system wasn't in place a long time ago. But now that we have the scoring system, we have all this paperwork. And there are still some shows that I scribe for myself, and that's fine. I can do it. But you do take a chance on missing things whenever you look down for that split second to write down a score. Who knows what just occurred in front of you? So it's really nice to have a scribe. But if you're sitting there scribing, you're watching this ride go along, and you're listening to the judge speak it and score it. And then pretty soon, I mean, you're learning all this knowledge that you're gaining.
Yeah.
And
it's
probably the best learning tool for someone who wants to improve their showing or become a judge.
That's a very good way
of looking at it. I didn't think of it from that perspective. You know, a competitor could totally do it and be like 10 steps ahead.
You just can't fathom the amount of knowledge you would gain as an exhibitor to go sit and scribe.
Yeah. That's very cool. I mean, like I said, I had no idea that that even happened. I must have been living under a rock because I had no idea that that was happening or people did it, you know? So that's
right. Really
cool.
Right, yeah, it is. It's a great, great tool for people to learn.
Now, what's one of the best, I know you've already been to Mexico, been to Australia, but what's one of the best facilities or places that you enjoy going to in the United States that you've been so far that you really liked to visit? Not necessarily the show, you know, I don't want to rank shows, but area and facilities that you've been.
You know, I've been to lots of really neat places. It's hard to narrow down to just one. I'll tell you one cool place that comes to mind is in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. They have the Kirkwood I don't know if it's the, I think it's the community college, but it's their main thing at that college is hospitality. So they have a really nice equine facility, but then not far from it, as part of the college campus, they have a hotel and restaurant. And
oh,
it's
cool.
A very, very upscale hotel. And so, like, I flew into little Podunk Cedar Rapids, and they send somebody in a limousine. It wasn't a stretch limousine, but a limousine to pick me up. And, I mean, it's just class act. And I get there, and the bellman takes my luggage to my room in a really, really nice upscale room and upscale dinner at their restaurant. So I thought that was really a neat place, and always enjoy going there.
How cool is that? And this is in Iowa.
In Iowa, in the middle of the cornfields.
How cool is that? Because I've had a lot of people tell me, you know, like I've had conversations where, like, you know, certain places are really saturated with horses and some aren't, and then people migrate to other places and things of that nature. And I didn't realize Iowa, Illinois, Wisconsin, all that kind of area up there had so much horse stuff going on. Like, I was, like, mind blown the more I talked to people about it. It is a lot of horse people up there.
There are, and there's a lot of really good horses up there in the Midwest. There's a lot of really good Western pleasure horses and a lot of really good halter horses up in that area. And I've even gone to places out in the country like Cobleskill, New York, and you drive through the countryside, and it's just exquisite through the hills and the different terrain and the different landscape, and it's just really nice to take all that in. Oregon and Washington. Oregon is probably the prettiest state.
Really?
The prettiest states I've been to.
I wouldn't have thought, I mean, I don't want to offend Oregon in any way, shape, or way,
but I never
would have thought that. I would have been like, oh, I would have thought Oregon would be like, you would think Arizona, a little more desert, a lot of land, a lot of, like, I didn't think it would have, that's cool to hear that, though.
But probably the pretty, well, I would say the most majestic place is flying into Salt Lake City, Utah. It's just such a very clean city. Everybody's yards and homes and everything is just very neatly manicured and very clean. But surrounding the city is the mountains, and it's just exquisite. It is
so
beautiful.
Cool.
And you walk out of the arena of the facility, and there are the mountains. Just like, it looks like you can touch them.
That is so,
so we
cool,
because
I'm living
see,
for you.
We get to see everything from, you know, the beaches of Florida to the mountains of Cheyenne. I mean, you see it all, and that is definitely a bonus and a benefit. Now, travel these days can be a little tough. I know my good friend Sherry Haynes went to Cedar Rapids, Iowa, excuse me, this past weekend, and normally it's about a two-hour flight there and back to get there, and, well, coming home yesterday, her flights were just delay after delay after delay, and I don't think she got back to DFW until about 1 o'clock this morning. So travel is not necessarily glamorous.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it beats the alternative of having to drive it. Good Lord.
No kidding.
But that does take, I mean, it took, you know, a lot of judges end up staying more, like, localized. They end up doing kind of just a set series and a set area. So it's really cool that you are kind of in a different, you literally go everywhere. And that's cool that you're able to do that, because not a lot of people do that.
Right, and it's all because of the horse. And, you know, I've met so many very interesting, unique people and been to exquisite places all because of the horse. I owe it all to the horse.
Yeah. No, none of this would be possible without the horse.
And I guess my parents, because they brought me in to this world loving horses.
Okay, I've prepared for this.
Okay.
I get a lot of really, really good feedback. It's a big place. It's a nice place, et cetera, but I literally kind of had this conversation with somebody else. It feels like that particular, it's gotten a lot of hype, but a lot of folks I've talked to have kind of said that the place looks like it's gearing more towards certain disciplines, and then the cost to put on a show there is outrageous. So I've kind of gotten different.
Now, are you speaking of WEC?
Yes.
Okay. I haven't been to WEC yet. I'm going in February, but I've seen lots of pictures, and I've had lots of friends go that have been there, and they say it's absolutely exquisite, and it looks that way. And I'm certain that it costs a lot of money to rent the facility. But Florida as a whole, they've got a lot of good horses down there and a lot of good people. It can get pretty hot in the summertime.
Yeah.
That's for sure. But, no, I enjoy going to Florida, and I'm really looking forward to judging at WEC in February.
Oh, very cool. Well, yeah, I mean, I've heard for the majority, most people are like, it's a gorgeous place, you know. But a lot of people have kind of said that it's getting to where certain disciplines are kind of only going to be down there. And I was kind of having a conversation with somebody else about the same thing because, you know, Florida does have a lot of horses down there. It's a lot of people that do horses down there. And
they do.
To be able to kind of have a facility or a place that can start to concentrate more on, like, reined cow and cow events would be good.
Right.
I didn't realize it was that many cow people down there, for better lack of terms.
Yeah. And I don't know that WEC is geared for that.
That's what I'm trying to get at.
I haven't seen any of those events that have occurred there, and maybe they're not set up for that. And I can't say that I've ever judged a lot of reining or cow horses down there. I have judged some at some breed shows, but it wasn't a large number of exhibitors in it.
I think that's amazing what they do, because I talked to somebody who put it into perfect perspective. He was like, here you've got three disciplines crammed into one horse, where you've got everybody
right.
else puts a full concentration on, you know, each one and all of the money and the different associations. And Rank Cow just said, we're going to do it all at once. And it's amazing
right,
to watch
right.
them horses.
It is. It is. It is exhilarating to watch a good cow horse.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well,
But I don't like. Yeah, I don't think Florida's just really known for having a lot of those events down there, as some other states are.
Yeah. Yeah, because I mean, you know, a lot of people. It's hard to kind of please everybody. Period. You know, that's never going to happen. You know, let's be
Absolutely.
Realistic. But it's cool to kind of hear how much of that is down there, and there is a need for it. Like, you know, these people are starting to really travel, like me and this other girl were talking about it a couple of weeks ago, to be able to do these types of events. So I hope they look into kind of bringing it or making it available for associations to bring it there.
Yes, absolutely. That would be great. And, you know, they do have some cuttings down there.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
they do have
right.
some of those, but and I guess what you and I are maybe trying to say, or we're seeing and feeling, is that they, you know, they don't have a lot of the aged events, and that would probably be due to their location. You know, they're not as centrally located for people to come from various places. Maybe that plays a role. I really don't know why. It's kind of strange with Florida. Actually, they say Ocala is the horse capital of the world, having the largest horse population. So it is kind of strange that a state with as many horses as they have, they're not known for having major cow, horse, and cutting events.
Yeah. 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 That's
that
exactly what I'm trying to say. Yeah, it does kind of make you think, because it sucks to have to I mean, it's not like a plane. You can't hop on a plane, like you said. You can't go somewhere, Iowa, in 2 hours, be back later with horses. I mean,
right.
It's an ordeal to travel.
It's a trek.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, it's amazing to me to see the way these shows have went. Again, maybe I was living under a rock, but to hear of, like, the biggest show you possibly had that we went to do was maybe a week long. That was our state show. And now you've got shows that last 3 weeks, 4 weeks, and your typical weekend show is now like a week long. And to have to prepare for that and do for that and haul for horses and stuff, that's crazy.
It is. You know, we have so many classes that we offer now that it just takes a lot of time.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of time.
Well, I mean, your average person with a 9-to-5, they can't necessarily go to those things.
No, it's hard on them. And kids being in school, they have to get out of school, pulled out of school for days and weeks at a time. And it does make it tough.
But it's for the horse.
For the love of the horse.
There's that meme where, you've probably seen it, where the horse is, it shows it pulling the buggy, and then it shows a picture of the horse in a trailer, and it goes, well played, well played.
Well played. Yes.